Bring a Trailer podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Bring a Trailer podcast. Alex here, joined by Randy. How are you, Randy?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Today, we are very excited to be joined by Colin Comer. He's kind of an everything in the classic car world guy. He's a restorer, he's an appraiser, he's a buyer, he's a seller on Bring a Trailer, a journalist, an author of books, a pilot. That's not really the car world stuff. But anyway, we're excited to have you, Colin. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Excited to be here.
Thank you so much, man. We really appreciate it. I know Randy may have some burning questions. Both of us have a hunger to buy a Mustang, maybe a Shelby. So maybe you can walk us through that. But thought we'd go through your career first, if that's okay. So were Shelbys and Mustangs always the dream for you? Or were there other cars competing for your attention? How did you get into this world?
Well, the Shelbys, you know, I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So it's not like we had, you know, an overwhelming supply of Cobras and GT350s because of the climate and the frugal nature of the people that live here. But, you know, I worked in a garage and we had muscle cars roll in once in a while. And I always thought they were cool, but they're a little bit ponderous. And, you know, the more I studied, the more I read about stuff and dug into history, I kind of, oh, here's a car. It's kind of like a muscle car, but it won, you know, B Production National Championship. So, and then you get into the history of Carroll Shelby and winning Le Mans. And even before it was a movie, it was a great story. So always an aspirational car, but I never thought I would be able to have one. Not only did I not think I could find one, but I thought pretty certain I could never afford one. So I don't know what happened, but here we are.
A couple good things happened. You were a teenager when you were working on these cars, right? And you were a wrench to start with, isn't that right?
I was. I bought my first car when I was 12 with paper out, snow shoveling money and stuff like that. And that happened to be a Mustang. That was a 68 Mustang convertible that was, you know, bashed up. And I tried to hide it around the corner from my parents' house. And my mom kind of put two and two together and told me I need to get rid of that thing before my dad found out. So I did. And then I had a little bit of money and my dad helped me buy a British car when I was 13 because he really thought he wanted a British car. So that's how that worked. but yeah, I worked in a garage. I worked in the local service station. I was their paper boy. And I kept going in there delivering their paper every day, and I wouldn't leave. I'd hang out and watch them do body work and talk to the mechanics and talk to the guy owning the garage. And one day he said, hey, he goes, you're here all the time. Do you want a job? And I said, I do. And I went outside and I threw all my newspapers into the dumpster, and I was done being a paper boy, and I was working at the Downer Avenue Garage in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Never looked back, huh?
I looked back a few times.
Awesome, man. What was the British car?
MGB GT.
Oh, I like those.
My dad bought one of those new. I'd totally love those. Those are in our family. Those are super cool. What was it? Was it a beater or was it actually pretty nice?
Well, it taught me exactly how not to buy a car.
I love these. These are new stories for me, Colin. Mustang convertible and then a BGT and then onward and upward.
I was going to ask when the first Shelby was, but maybe the better question is what else is in between the MGB and the first Shelby? Colin, you were telling us about a couple of the interim cars between MGB GT and the first couple of Shelbys. Tell us about that Alpha. It was a 69. What was the year?
It was a 69 1750 Euro car. It was like a jade green, super cool car. Had tobacco interior with the buttress seats and Weber's Euro airbox. The whole deal. Had some old basket weave mags on it because it was the 80s. At the time, you know, you're a kid, you don't know, but it was a really cool car and I didn't know that because I just saw it on the side of the road for sale and, you know, talked to the guy, asked him if I could take it for a test drive, you know, because he said he wanted $2,500 and in my world, that seemed like it was possible, even though it wasn't. So he's like, I'll take you for a ride. And we get in this car and he goes blasting through this 35 mile an hour residential area of town at like 90. And I'm thinking, this guy is nuts. He's going to kill me. And we're piling up to a stoplight. I'm like, it's a red light. I'm like, he's not going to stop. And he nails the brakes and the thing like plants you into the seat belts. And I thought, what the heck? And he's like, four wheel disc brakes. So it's like, this thing was no MGB GT. So I had to have it. And I went home, couldn't figure out how I was going to make the swing because I had to sell my car first. So in passing, I just told my dad, like, I went, took a test ride in this car and got to figure it out. I even had the guy on the test drive. Now that I remember, I had the guy drive it to my mom's office and parked outside of the window of her office. And I walked inside and said, Mom, can you loan me some money so I can buy this car? And she goes, no, you don't need a car. You have a car. So that was that. So somehow it came around that my dad caught wind of it. I told him whatever. And without my knowledge, he went and bought it from the guy. And came to me and said, all right, I bought the car. It's my car. If you want to buy it from me, sell your car, bring me the money and buy it from me. So that's what I did. And it was an awesome car. I mean, that thing was great. In the 6 or 8 weeks that I owned it, it was wonderful, you know, camping trips. And I mean, that thing just pulled the, seemed like 20,000 RPM, but it was probably more like 6,500. But, you know, proper Euro car was just awesome. So that was the first real sports car that I feel like I had.
And how old were you for that? You were driving it around, so you were 16 plus, but what were you, 16, 17?
I was 16. I just, because I'm a December kid, so I got my license a little early versus other kids that were in school with me. So I was like the first kid in class to get a driver's license. I was a sophomore in high school, bought this car right before summer vacation and had some new wheels. I was on summer vacation and I was going to get some summer jobs. So you have to get a work permit. So I went to my high school to pick up a work permit. And I was driving back through Milwaukee to go down to apply for a job and started hustling through some stoplights. And they're slowly going green, yellow, yellow. I know what the next color is. So I come up on one and I'm like, ah, my luck's out. I got to stop for this one. And I nail the brakes and there's nothing there. The pedal just goes right to the floor. So I look and of course here from the red light to my right is a unmarked squad car going back to the Milwaukee Police Department, which is like two blocks away for a shift change. Apparently he was late. So he sees me, I see him. I go to the right trying to throw it around the back of his car and he goes to the left thinking he was going to avoid me. And we end up going head on into each other. It was really awesome. So, you know, it was pretty good because it shoved the engine and transmission of my car into the passenger seat and kind of messed up his Dodge Diplomat. Oh, and parts of his car went through the plate glass window of the Greyhound bus station we were in front of. It was not the prettiest scene ever, especially when he told me to come over and take off his gun belt. And I'm taking off his gun belt and like 15 other cop cars show up because it's right next to the police station. And these cops all come over and they all start freaking out because there's some 16-year-old kid taking a gun off of an officer. So, hey, man, he told me to. So that was the end of that GTV, long story short.
Well, what's next? What replaces it? That's a sad fate for such a wonderful car.
I'm glad you're okay. I mean, engines in the passenger seat, I don't ever want to get in an accident in an old Alfa, but it sounds like you did fine and walked away.
Yeah, it turned out it was a pretty rusty car underneath the shiny paint, so it kind of folded pretty quickly. Yeah, so, you know, I had it hauled to the body shop that I worked at and fought with the insurance for a while. They were going to fix it, not fix it, fix it, not fix it. In the end, they ended up totaling it, and I bought it back for salvage because I wanted the Weber carbs, the cool seats, and whatever else was left of it. And I went to the local Alfa dealer when we still had such a thing with my insurance check. And I bought a 72 GTV that was just traded in on a GTV6. And I still have that car today.
I knew you had one of these long term. I thought you were going to tell me that the crashed cop car was the one you kept, but you ditched that one and then you kept a different one.
No, that the one that was crashed was comprehensively destroyed. Even today, you wouldn't restore it. If it was a 250 GTO, they wouldn't have restored it.
That thing was a goner. Okay. Yeah, I knew you had super long-term ownership. And then I thought this story may slip and slide into a GTV6 Callaway story eventually. I know you're passionate about that model as well. But anyway, we can string together the resume on cars here as long as you want, Alex.
I'm just trying to steer us to the first Shelby because that's what I'm curious about. I mean, Randy's talking about you're a young guy owning Shelbys. I'm curious how that happens.
Well, it took a long time to get a Shelby, or at least it felt like a really long time, because I worked my way through Alphas and other kind of stuff and restoring cars for people. And it was a while before, you know, I took a swing at a couple of GT350s because they seemed like maybe I could make it happen. But I mean, you're talking to a guy who went and bought a new 5-liter Mustang and made 3 payments and decided I had to get off that ride. So, I mean, it wasn't like I was flush. I was just trying to do what I could do. So my first GT350, my first Shelby was, early 2000s. So it was kind of I'm not really responsible with money, or at least I've been told. You know, anytime I had enough money to buy a Shelby, probably I went and spent it on race cars or buying a paint booth or something that wasn't as much fun in the end. You know, yeah, so I bought a GT350 from an estate sale eventually, and that kind of started that part of my adventure.
And you said you had been chasing Shelbys before that. So there was interest in buying one before. I mean, I think of you as Mr. Shelby, but I'm not sure if that car kind of ignited it or increased the love for the Shelbys or whether that was always kind of the direction you were headed.
I don't know if the path was really clear because before there were Shelbys, I actually ended up having some other like interesting stuff. I had a number of Ferrari Dinos. I had a Lawn Nose 275 GTB that was like the fourth Lawn Nose car built. This is how long ago that was. I bought it at an RM auction at Meadowbrook. And I drove there from Milwaukee with a buddy of mine, and I went there to buy a Lusso. It was another estate sale. They were selling a you know, some moldy old Ferraris from an estate, kind of like they did in Monterey last year, but these were, you know, even worse. So I went there to buy this Lusso, and I thought, I just sold my Dino at Barrett Jackson. I had bought a Dino for like $35,000, and the market started to take off again, and I sold it for, I don't know, $90,000. So I had $90,000 in my pocket. And I had a banker who just told me that he would finance any difference. But he said, I trust you. He's like, if you go there and buy a car, write the check, hurry back here, I'll give you the money. But you got to get me the title like right away because I could lose my job. So I went there to buy a Lusso, and I looked at the Lusso and I looked at the GTB, and I thought, I don't know, I'm going to see what plays out here. And I just couldn't do it with the Lusso. And I thought the GTB was like $20,000 more, which was a huge amount of money. But I thought, I'm going to take a swing at the GTB. And I ended up getting the 275 GTB for like $120,000 or something like that, or $115,000. And I thought it was a short nose car with a long nose grafted onto it. But then when I got home, I called my buddy, the Ferrari historian, and he goes, oh, no, that's the way it should be. That car was a long nose originally. It was like a prototype. So, but I drove it home from Michigan, and I went through like two cases of oil between Meadowbrook and Milwaukee because it used so much oil. It was ridiculous. But yeah, so in between the Alphas and the MGs and the Shelbys, there was a bunch of Ferraris, a bunch of Hemi cars, muscle car stuff. You know, buying stuff, restoring it, playing with it, just always robbing Peter to pay Paul, kind of.
I was on an event with you a couple years ago, and you pointed to an orange Ferrari Daytona, which is one of the best looking Daytonas I've ever seen. And you said it used to be your car. Is that the era when you had that car?
No, that was a more recent Daytona that I had. Way back when, it was funny because I had a Dino Spider, and a friend of mine had a Daytona Spider. And he said that his wife wanted a Dino Spider. And he goes, why don't you take the Daytona Spider for a day, drive around. I'll let my wife drive around your Dino. And if she likes it, we'll trade. I said, okay. We went back and I said, here's a Daytona Spider back. And he goes, yeah, good. We'll do the trade. And I said, no, actually, I don't like this Daytona Spider. I want to keep my Dino. It's more fun. And I still have that Dino today.
Amazing. Did you know Colin had all this Ferrari history, Randy?
I've seen a few cars go through and him make a few remarks like this. But it, I mean, we jumped a few chapters forward there, I feel like, right? We were talking like rusty Alphas for $2,500. Then all of a sudden, financing Lusso auction purchases. Like, I never made that leap, dude. I think that's where you and I kind of parted ways, right? Like, I was buying salvage title 2002s, and Colin started going and figuring out how to...
He had bankers, Randy.
I didn't know. I was doing other stuff. But well, I mean, I really loved watching it from the sidelines. It's been super impressive to watch your whole trajectory, Colin.
I always wanted these cars. And I just worked. It's all I did. I just worked every day. When I was in high school, I had three jobs. When I started my business, I worked there 7 days a week. I still work there 7 days a week. I only work half days, only 12 hours a day now. So, you know, it's like I just worked and just saved up. And I'm like, okay, these cars are getting more expensive. You know, it's like you see something slipping away. It's how I bought my first 289 Cobra. They were 80 grand, 90 grand, 100 grand. It was the same thing with Tom Cotter. You know, him and Peter Egan went to go get his car. And I read about him, like, these guys are onto something. Like, he's right. You got to buy it now. Otherwise, it's gone. So I sold my house to buy a 289 Cobra. I was like, I can buy another house. So I was like basically homeless going to RM Monterey to buy a 289 Cobra that was, again, like a bankruptcy sale. And even Rob Meyer, who came over and sat down next to me and said, will you stop bidding? You're nuts. And Jack Bockstrom, who worked at RM, and he's like, the guys who are running RM auctions. They came and sat on either side of me. And they're like, will you please stop bidding? You're making a mistake. I said, no, I don't think I am, because next year this car is going to be 100 grand more. So and I'm still talking about buying cars that are millions today. We're just over $100,000 then.
Yeah, it's super amazing. And I don't know. I love delving into this more because it's kind of like a entrepreneurial success story, right? Like you took the risks and figured out how to get the cash and get these cars and saw beforehand that these were going to be valuable. So I think that's super cool. And I don't mind that your dog's barking in the back. I know that you're at home and you got family running all over and it's all good. We've got that scenario too. But anyway, I think a lot of people... Like I was obsessed with classified ads when I was a kid, and it seems like you were swimming around looking at cars and flipping cars and doing stuff. But I think the print ad days that I tell people about now that makes me sound like a total old man, like a speedster in the San Jose Mercury News, it was super normal for there to be speedsters for 35 grand. And like Shelby's were like high 30s, but a Hertz car was like 22.5 or 24.5, where you'd get the discount. I'm sure you remember those days of fishing around and seeing those cars pop up. And that was... late 80s, early 90s, I think.
Yeah. It was, so I saved a lot of the ads. I used to go to California, Arizona to buy cars, and I was bringing home truckloads of cars, you know, because I was selling late model cars to make money. and I was buying collector cars to have fun with. And it was one of those things where I would save the ads, like 446 pack CUDA convertible and 18.5 were best offer. So I clipped some of those out and saved them because I thought this might be a moment in time.
I would hang them on my wall because I didn't have any money to buy them. But I'd like put a Speedster ad like taped next to my car posters because I thought it was like a cool thing. So anyway, it's funny. I just think that era is so archaic sounding now, pre-internet newspaper arriving in your driveway that says there's a Speedster for sale. But I don't know why that like 30 to 35 grand level is what is so memorable to me about when these cars, that say now are six-figure cars or seven-figure cars or whatever, they were in that sort of range. And it was just, but that was totally out of reach. I mean, that was like twice the price of the car my mom drove or whatever, right? So it was like, there was no way that was ever happening in our family. But I just love that you latched onto that and started buying and selling some of these cars. And then, yeah, we ought to talk about some of the sort of highlights of the different vehicles that have come through. Because there was a, not to jump ahead here, but we've listed a couple real R models on BAT, and those have crazy checkered past. And Colin's always sort of an authority on knowing what's real and what's not. But then you'll just casually drop like, oh, yeah, I've, like six of the R models have come through my ownership at a different time. And it just blows me away to hear that and that context and just that those have flowed through your shop. But maybe that's a model to chat about or just other Shelby's, but I'm sure some people would love to hear some of those stories.
Yeah, well, I've always been kind of a historian, I guess. I researched the cars and figured out in 1983 or 84, my dad gave me this big book of like collector cars. I think it's called the Collector Car Almanac or something like that. And it had all the cool cars in there, pretty much every car that was worthwhile. And it had like value today, value in 5 years, value in 10 years or 15 years, wherever it was. And I went through there and circled a bunch of cars. In 1984, like these are the cars I need to buy because their 5-year prediction is pretty good. Like if I could buy them now or in 5 years, then the 15-year projection still looked pretty good. I have it on my bookshelf still today. And I look at it once in a while just for a laugh, but it's, you know, 65 GT350, 427 Cobras. And it was funny, like they give you the pros and cons. You know, Randy, you like this. I circled all the Chrysler letter cars and, you know, the highs were great performance, stunning looks. The lows are, it's a Chrysler, they rust out. You know, it's like they give you pros and cons, like on a Ferrari 250 short wheelbase, you know, like cons were parts can be expensive, you know, yeah. Stuff like that. And this was at the time where a friend of our family, and again, you know, I make that sound like we grew up wealthy and had a bunch of rich friends. We didn't. But we had a friend who was really kind of early into the Ferrari thing, two friends actually. And one of them had a 250 GTO when I was, you know, 13, 14, 16 years old, somewhere in there. And he kept saying, this is going to be the first $1 million car. And I'm like, yeah, no car's ever going to sell for $1 million. And we're like driving the thing to the store. It's like, okay, $1 million, no way. And his buddy, another friend, he had a 250 TDF. And these were just running around, just driving his cars. And, you know, those days are unfortunately gone because a lot of people won't experience what we experienced just using the car as a car. So that's why like 1,000-mile tours and stuff kind of warm my heart because you don't know the car until you drive it and get to spend time with it and know how it smells, know how it sounds, all that kind of stuff. So, but I'm just sounding like the get off my lawn guy right now.
That's what I start to sound like too, man. But I love this. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. For me, we didn't have the family friends doing that, but we'd make a pilgrimage to Fantasy Junction across the bay or whatever. And you'd see those cars and blow you away that those cars were just kind of cruising around. Oh yeah. What's out behind the shop? Oh yeah. That's a, you know, Lusa we're fixing up to sell. And it's kind of junky or whatever, you know? And right. Nowadays it's just like, oh, it's such a cherished piece and you can't find one that isn't perfect and going through a big auction for big commissions. It's just a fun world to look back on how it was a little more casual.
And like when I had, you know, I was working on these cars for other people. I worked on cars for collectors. I was restoring cars and, you know, I was restoring 35B Bugattis and 8C Alphas and, you know, all this weird stuff. It was just a job for me. I was working on the cars. But I remember one time a guy had an Alloy 4-cam and the windshield wiper motor was up at Motion Products at Wayne Obrey's shop in Neenah, which is, you know, 2 hours away. And the guy who owns the car, he goes, well, go pick up the windshield wiper motor from Wayne, but drive the car up there and make sure you put it in with him there so you make sure it works before you drive the car home. I don't want him to ship the motor here if it doesn't work. So I start driving this 4-cam up in the rain. You know, it starts raining. I'm like, well, I don't have a windshield wiper motor. At like 100 miles an hour, the rain kind of went off the windshield. So I'm just going on the road, you know, 5,500 RPM in fifth gear in an Alloy 4-cam. going to Neenah, Wisconsin, in the middle of a farm field to pick up a wiper motor so I could have wipers on the way home. And you look back and you think it was so miserable at the time. And now you think like that was one of the best days of my life.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. I love hearing about the business and the stories and how it's grown. And I follow your photos and your feeds, and I've never visited your shop, but I'd still love to visit your shop and come out and just kind of peek around. I'm sure there's a bunch of good stuff.
Yeah, you should. You should. And you know, we've got cheese and custard and
Culver's. You have Culver's down the road, I'm sure.
Oh, we have the places that Culver's copied.
You've had so many cars pass through your hands. Maybe one of the entry points is, are there cars that did pass through your hands or through your ownership that you kind of think about the most, or that you regret getting rid of the most, the cars that you wish you'd kept?
Oh man, there's so many of them. But you know what? I always tell myself I made the right decision at the time, because again, I couldn't buy another car unless I sold a car. So if I had one cool old car, you know, most of the time I had to get rid of it to get something else, which is okay when you're buying new cars. If you bought, you know, a Viper this year and you wanted to buy next year's Viper, no big deal. But when you have something like a Comp Cobra and you sell it, and then you realize, well, that was kind of a mistake. You know, I was partners in ownership of a Cobra Daytona Coupe. And, you know, we brought it to auction and it didn't sell. And my partners were kind of desperate to get out, and they were willing to take, I could have bought it at a loss. And I thought, all right, I really should buy this Daytona Coupe because there's six of them and it's a great car. But then I thought, you know, I drove the thing to get coffee and it was kind of miserable compared to a Cobra Roadster. And I just thought, I'm not going to drive it as much as I would drive the Roadster. So I kept the Cobra Roadster and we cashed out of the Daytona Coupe, which was a huge mistake, by the way. That was a tremendous, tremendous mistake looking back. But you can never, we never predicted $70 million GTOs. So, but yeah, there's a lot of cars. I mean, some of the cars that I got rid of, they're not worth anything, but it's like you wish you had them back. Stupid stuff. Like, you know, I had a 750 Giulietta Coupe that I loved. I had a Land Cruiser that I loved. You know, these cars that you kind of, they come and go, and there's just good memories associated with them, or they were a good car, you know, that kind of stuff.
What was miserable about a Daytona Coupe compared
hot.
To a
I'm
Roadster?
I'm sure it's hot, and it's like a race car, and you try to drive it on the street, and it's a nightmare. That would be my guess, but yeah. What was the reality?
Well, it was funny because I was nervous about it because I went
Daytona Coupe insights. You don't get these very often,
no,
Colin. We've got
I'm
got
only
to take
speculation on this, right? I'm like, there's no personal experience whatsoever.
Well, it was nerve-wracking because I was put in charge of picking the car up. It was out in Arizona. It was at Harley Cluxton's shop. So I picked up from Harley Cluxton's, and my partners were extremely nervous. They said, make sure you get this car to your house and park a bunch of cars around it. Make sure nobody can get into the garage door and, you know, sleep in it or something. So, of course, we had it delivered to my house in Arizona and parked a bunch of cars around it. And I thought, all right, this is stupid. The next morning, I'm like, I'm taking this car for a drive. So I'm like, if something goes wrong, I'll just buy these guys out. I'll figure out a way. So I went and drove it. You know, it's flat spotted old Blue Streak tires and stuff. They don't really work until you get everything hot. It really sounded like a car that was designed on a garage floor. The panels are all flapping around and it's miserably hot. And again, I sound like an old man, but compared to a Roadster, you don't notice in a Roadster how hot it is because your feet are on fire, but the rest of you is okay. Not in a coupe. Like you're entirely on fire from your head to your toes. So I thought I would never do a 1,000-mile rally in this car. It would be nobody would want to ride with me.
How about a couple thousand miles around the Le Mans circuit and that thing?
Yeah, we've certainly softened up since that stuff happened. Drivers today, if their air conditioning goes out, they come in and park the car.
What's the dream for 1,000 miles, Colin? Maybe we can pivot into Mustangs that Randy and I want. Those certainly seem to be popular on these road racing events. What are the highlights for you in terms of best cars for doing 1,000 miles?
Well, I've done probably 30,000-mile rallies, and I think I've done over 20 of them in either a GT350, 65 or 66, or a Cobra. Really, especially like if you're doing the Copper State 1000, which is obviously in Arizona, and it's hot, and the sun's pretty brutal because you're right next to it. A white Mustang coupe is really kind of enjoyable. You put the windows down, and it doesn't get too hot inside, and if it breaks, you walk to a Napa, and you get the parts, and you fix it. That's why I like the stuff, because I like cars that aren't mechanically intimidating. So if you take a 300 SL on a rally, which is a very popular rally car, and your fuel injection pump packs up, well, what are you going to do? You can't just bolt a Holley on it and keep going. You know, you can't go to Napa and say, I need 8 pistons for my diesel injection pump that's pumping gasoline currently, you know, whatever the deal is. So, you know, I've taken European cars on these tours and they're great. you can cruise 120 miles an hour, but honestly, you're not doing that the whole time. So I like mechanical simplicity and something that's kind of loud and rowdy and fast, and you can fix it.
I think I recall this correctly. For Road and Track, didn't you drive a Cunningham or some kind of wild open competition car on one of those rallies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a Cunningham team car, Knobbly Lister, a Lister Jag. One of the
on the road? You drove that on the road event?
Oh, yeah. Wow. I drove it all the time on the road. I mean, I had a D-Type. I drove it to work, you know, so this was like nothing. A Knobbly Lister is like, I mean, it's just a straight six Jaguar engine with a Moss box. You know, what could go wrong? So, yeah, I took it on the Copper State 1000 with my buddy Sam Smith. We were both at Road and Track at the time. And, you know, Sam's a little guy. So I thought he's the only guy who would fit on top of the oil tank and the oil lines and sit next to the exhaust on the right side of the car.
Alex would have volunteered. Alex would have volunteered to fit.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It got so hot leaving Phoenix. We pulled over and took out the middle of the hood, came out like some Zeus fasteners. And it was so hot. I'm like, we got to take the middle of the hood out. So we took the hood out and found a crew vehicle and threw part of the hood in the crew vehicle and ran with the thing open so the engine could vent because we were just getting roasted. So we did that for, you know, the 1,000-mile thing. And Sam kept wanting to drive, which anybody would do. He's like, I want to drive. You know, he's like Ricky Bobby. Like, let me drive. I'm like, all right. So he pulled into a rest stop. And I'm like, you drive. I'll get in the passenger side. And I like folded myself in there. And it was totally uncomfortable. I took out the seat cushion because otherwise I was like 5 feet above the windscreen. I even made a Road Rally windshield for it. Went to an airplane windshield place and had to make like a 4-inch taller windscreen for it so we could be a little bit protected. And I wasn't on that side for like, I'm a really bad passenger to begin with, but the thing had a tilt and clutch and it was a little racy. And I put a really tall gear in it so we could go like 200 miles an hour if we wanted to. And Sam was having a hard time getting it going. And I'm really bad with people that are abusing stuff mechanically. So I was like, get out. I'm like, you're not driving. So I pulled over and he's like, yeah, I don't want to drive anyway. It's too stressful with you next to me. So I drove the rest of the way and I was like, okay, we did it and we made the tour and the thing was great and didn't break. And I don't know if I would do it again.
Yeah, I don't think I'd take a British. I think I'm never taking a British car on the Copper State. Copper State needs an American V8, in my opinion.
Well, you wrote in your buddy's NASCAR that he took on that event.
Yeah, like, Stuart, I think about that. Stuart ran the U-Haul NASCAR Torino on that and let me ride shotgun. That was sort of fun. I mean, there's Porsches that run that event and there's all sorts of different stuff. But Kanye, I think you're dead on in taking a US V8 powered car that the Napa Auto can basically fix 80% of your problems.
Falcon carburetors can even
those
be fixed.
Need some work. I hear those need some work every once in a while.
I'm always happy to offer support for other Ford powered cars on these things.
Yeah, you were very helpful, Colin. I'm a lot of gratitude
beer-skies.
For that.
Many beer skis.
Many brew skis. Talk to us a little bit about your pivot to writing. So you're kind of noted author, Shelby expert. I used to read your work in Road and Track all the time. How did that come about? Was it something you always wanted to do or something that came about on accident?
No, I never wanted to write. I actually almost flunked out of high school because of English. You know, I went to a Jesuit high school and they were really strict and I just didn't want to do any writing. So that almost was the straw that broke the camel's back. But speaking of like the Copper State and Cobras, I was on the Copper State 1 year in a 289 Cobra and was going way too fast, like 140 miles an hour. And a cop that wasn't along with us for the Copper State was not impressed with my speed. So I got like a tremendous ticket. And it turned out I bargained it down to doing online traffic school from Wisconsin. So I'm sitting at my computer in Wisconsin doing online traffic school late one night. It's like midnight. And I thought I could just breeze through it. But it turns out they time every page. So you can't like flip to the next page unless you've spent 3 minutes on the page. Because I really want you to know why you can't turn right on red, apparently. So I'm reading Sports Car Market. And this was 2004. And the cover of Sports Car Market was the muscle car market's crashing, get out while you can, you know, women and children first, that kind of thing. So I look in there, I'm like, oh, Keith Martin, I'd subscribed with Keith since the Alfa Romeo market letter days. So I sent him an email and just said, hey, you're an idiot. Don't write about muscle cars if you don't know the market. And he emails me back and he goes, well, tell me what we're doing wrong. I said, well, you got everything wrong. I said, you don't know anything. I said, you're picking all the wrong cars. You're telling me that a LS6 Chevelle is not worth any money because somebody couldn't sell an engine swapped 300 horsepower Chevelle. Like, it's really not the right thing. So we kind of got into an argument because we're friends and we do that. And he's like, great. Well, you write for us. I said, sure, I'll write for you. Bring it on. And the next morning, I get an email from his managing editor or something. He's like, hey, here you're writing for us. I'm like, oh, crap. I wasn't serious. So that led to being, you know, many, many years of writing a column you know, doing the American car content for Sports Car Market. And I was editor at large for American Car Collector Magazine, Corvette Market Magazine. I did pretty much checks and balances on that stuff, which, you know, I didn't think anything of it. You write a column once a month. And then one day I'm at my shop and these guys show up and go, "Hey, we're from Motor Books International. Have you heard of us?" I'm like, "Yeah, you make the car books," because they're from Wisconsin. And they said, "We want you to write a book for us." I said, "No, I don't know how to write a book." And they said, "Well, just like doing a whole bunch of your columns, like we call those chapters." So they kind of explained how many words are in your columns. I said, "Oh, 1,500, 2,000. Great. You can make 2,000 word chapters and break it down and write a book for us." And I said, "I don't really want to do that." And I took one of them, Darwin Holmstrom. I took him for a ride. It was winter, but the roads were decent. I took him for a ride on a 427 Cobra. And it started snowing and he didn't say anything the whole ride. And we got back and he's like, "Dude, I've raced motorcycles my whole life. And that's the scariest freaking thing I've ever done." He's like, "You're insane." He's like, "You got to write a book for us because you're nuts. You fit right in." I said, "Okay." So I wrote a book and I thought that was it. I'm done with that. And then they came knocking again for another book and another book, another book. And now it's like 8 books. And I swear I'm done. I got to be done with this.
Can't wait to read the next one, Colin.
Which one was the first one, though? Which one was the one that they got you to write first off?
The first one was Million Dollar Muscle Cars, because I was kind of the muscle car guy back then. And I had a pretty good knowledge of muscle cars, and I was writing about it. And USA Today came when stuff was getting crazy in 2004, or 5 or 6. And they did like a big cover story on muscle cars and featured my dealership and my cars and what I was doing. And then it, you know, when you're on the front page of USA Today, then other people start calling. All of a sudden, I was getting quoted everywhere. And it was like a perfect storm. And all of a sudden, they wanted me to write a muscle car book because I was getting quoted about muscle car values. And we laughed about it. I thought, well, when they're selling this book as a closeout, they can call it Cars Formerly Known as Million Dollar Muscle Cars. But lo and behold, some of those million dollar cars are still worth that or more.
But they went through a season where they weren't. I think that'd be an interesting book about 6 years after that, right? And then it went through a trough and now they're back again. So
that's where they stopped printing, you know, new editions of that book was like 2008, 2009.
I'm glad you asked that question, Alex, because I wanted to know how you dove into that. And I knew about magazines, but then, yeah, writing books is a whole nother animal. We're in a lot of focus. And man, I don't know if you could be, you know, turning wrenches or running a staff in the garage while you're trying to focus on getting chapters out for a publisher who I'm sure is breathing down your neck. That's a tricky balance.
Yeah, well, the deal is I always wrote them at night. So if you really want to know the secret is when my wife went to bed or everything was quiet, the phone stopped ringing, the email stopped coming in, then I would sit there and write. I'd be like, okay, to get this book, I'm a procrastinator. So I would have like 2 years to write a book and 4 months to go. I'd sit down like, well, I should probably do an outline and start cranking out a chapter or two here and there. And they're history books. So you have to get the pictures to go with the story and the words. So finding the pictures is really the difficult part. You really have to start thinking about that well in advance, which I'm not great at. But I'd write them at night and go, okay, to make this June deadline, I have to write 4 chapters tonight. And I'd write all night and then I'd go to work in the morning and come home and proofread what I wrote the night before and then write 4 more chapters.
Geez, Randy, there's another similarity between you and Colin.
Well, yeah.
Do all the writing at midnight.
That's when you do it. That's when people are asleep and won't bother you or think it's an insane idea. So no, I love that.
Right.
I think that's fascinating. And not to pry too much, but I mean, is writing a profitable enterprise or are you doing this for charity? Like, I don't know if writing muscle car books is a viable profession I can tell my kid to start writing about, or is the restoration and buying and selling business what props up the writing business? How does that all work?
The writing is a total disaster. Like, I think the only way you can write a book and make money is if you self-publish. And I don't self-publish. I didn't care if I made money from the books. For me, it was, I've been really lucky to know a lot of the players, like a lot of, like, especially with Shelby, because I was so deeply involved and am still deeply involved with Shelby. But I got to know, you know, Peter Brock and Phil Remington and Carroll Shelby. These were all people that I was like close with. And you start thinking to yourself, like, these guys are leaving us and we need to get these stories down. I would sit down with Remington, all of a sudden he'd pop out a story that nobody ever heard before. The people that were there knew about it. But like when Chuck Cantwell starts telling about the day him and Ken Miles crashed Shelby's plane flying out to the desert to test race cars, like, have you told anybody this? Well, I don't think maybe Ken knew about it, but because he was there, you know. So I thought it was a duty to start writing this stuff down and getting the stories down and finding the old pictures and kind of documenting it, because I want these cars to live on. I want the stories to live on. I want my kids to know about this stuff. I want their kids to know about this stuff. So I kind of saw it as, if I can cover my cost, because you pay people for pictures, and if I can just cover that, then I'll be okay. And plus go back to my Jesuit high school and show them I'm in the Library of Congress.
That's right.
Yeah, do a burnout in a 427 Cobra
totally,
in the parking lot and say, look, I'm a writer.
Yeah.
That's the best.
Please amend my grades.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. You mentioned getting all these folks and their words and stories down. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed A.J. Baim, author of Go Like Hell, the Ford versus Ferrari Le Mans story for this podcast. And he said something very similar. You know, he wrote or was doing the research for that book in the mid-aughts. And so got to talk to a lot of these people and record their stories before we lost them. And it's, you know, it's not entirely unlike, you getting out ahead of the values of some of these cars, right? Like you don't know when these people are going to be gone. And so, you know, getting them down on paper or on recordings is super important work.
Yeah. Some of my most prized possessions are like the notes when I was writing stuff. I would write a chapter or write a story about Shelby and I would send it over to Remington and he had the most beautiful handwriting. And he would put notes on there and his handwriting was beautiful, but he didn't mince words. So like he would give them to his daughter to scan them and send them back to me, or he'd mail them back to me sometimes. And I get what I thought was the right thing. And then he would send it back and like cross out 90% of it and write in what really happened when he was there. But it was funny because I'm like, I can't believe I'm getting letters from Phil Remington. This is so fantastic.
You have Phil Remington marginalia in your collection there, Colin. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. Just to talk to these guys and get the stories. I wanted to write all the books as if, you know, I'm just sitting there with a guy getting a story down and then telling it to you. I wanted to tell it exactly as it was told to me and just a casual conversation like you just interviewed Peter Egan. He's the master. His conversational style is, I mean, it was like a guiding light for everybody who ever wanted to write about cars or the car hobby. So he's a national treasure. And I grew up reading his stuff. My formative years was reading Peter Egan. You read that stuff and it's like, okay, this guy is not talking down to you and he's not trying to show how smart he is. He's just telling you the story. Like, here are the facts. And that's what I always try to do. Just make it so people want to sit down and read it.
Yeah, completely unassuming. And he was like that in person. If it's okay, maybe we could shift gears here. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk Bring a Trailer a little bit. We've got Randy here. We've got you here. You've got your CC350 account on Bring a Trailer, Colin, saying before we were recording. It's old school. It's 2009, Randy. Can you believe that? Were you aware that that was Colin way back in the day? This is way pre-auction.
Totally. Well, you got to kind of decode it, right? The CC350 name I've always thought was clever and knew that he liked Shelby's and knew his initials. And you don't hide from things, right? I mean, your entity is called Colin's Classic Automobiles, so your name is out there. But no, 2009 was fairly early days for VAT, but as you can hear from all these stories, Colin was kind of rocking and rolling in the business. I would have been flattered for someone like him to sign up in 2009 when I was just sort of duct taping everything together. But fast forward, now we've got, I think it's, you know, well over 50, maybe approaching 60 cars that he's sold over the years on VAT. Commented on many more than that. Has an interesting mix. We associate you so closely with Shelby, Colin, but right now you got a BMW Z8 or Alpina Roadster, I think, and you've got like a pre-war Lincoln. You've got always interesting stuff. Are these like cars you went out and found? Are these clients with trades because they're trying to patch together a 427 Cobra purchase from you? Or like what are these cars doing moving through your shop?
Oh my God, you are too good. So those are trades on a 427 Cobra.
Get out of here, God, dude. I'm totally BSing and making that up. Are you kidding?
I kid you not. I just took four trades on a 427 Cobra.
Wait, can you say what the other two were? I want to know. I want to back of the napkin this thing. But a guy trades you a pre-war Lincoln on a Cobra. What are the other two?
A 67 Corvette.
Okay.
And a 73 Mustang.
Okay. All right. Well, we got the best two out of the four, I'll say. Well,
you're getting all four. Don't worry.
Okay, great. We get the vet too. I don't know about a 73 Mustang unless it's a special one.
Oh, wait until you see it. It's pretty ridiculous. Somebody restore like every part's NOS. Oh,
Colin, wow. Colin always has an amazing, like even if it's a pedestrian model, it's always well presented and always just a great car if it comes from Colin. I still remember the first one that I edited when I started Bring a Trailer was an Alfa.
I remember his car. So you remember the red Land Cruiser with the hood stripes on it that sold for $70,000 and I was outraged that someone would pay that much. But right now, I have a red 70s, late 70s FJ40, and it's a nightmare. And I was like, why didn't I just buy that one that he had? Like, that was like the best one. And he said so, and he told me I should buy it, and I was too much of a cheapskate. But anyway, lots of water under the bridge on the old CC350 account, Colin.
Yeah, well, in the pre-auction days is when I bought my FJ55 on Brand Trailer.
The blue and white one? You still have that, don't you?
Yeah. You had it as an exclusive, I think. It was a BAT exclusive, and I contacted the guy and said, I'll take it. And he
got cold feet, or what'd he do?
Yeah, he ghosted me.
Oh, or did he sell it to somebody else, or he just held on to it?
I thought he sold it to somebody else, but I said, hey, listen, I said, you know, I told you I'd pay your price. If you want more, just tell me what you want. I want an Iron Pig. And this was like original paint, low mileage. It's the one I wanted. And finally he gets a hold of me. He goes, I just decided to keep it. He goes, but I'll give you my word. I'll let you know when I decide to sell it. And I thought, yeah, everybody says that. And like 3 or 4 years later, he gets a hold of me and goes, are you still interested in my FJ55? I'm like, wow. Who's this?
Wow.
He goes, you contacted me on Brand Trailer and I told you I'd let you know. And I said, okay, what do you want for it? He goes, well, I'll sell it to you for what I was going to sell it to you back then. I just didn't want to sell it. I said, well, it's worth more. He said, no, you agreed to a price and I'm the one that backed out of the deal. I'll take that money for it. And I couldn't believe it.
Well done. And you flatter us hugely when you say I contacted him via Bring a Trailer, because that was me with
those
like
are
a,
cowboy days.
No, but that was like a Gmail inbox with me pressing forward manually. Like I would wake up and forward all the interest to the seller that we got the previous day, because we wouldn't publish obviously the seller's email address. Otherwise, like it would be a total circus. So I was like the manual forwarder of contact on BAT.
That's awesome.
It's how it all started, Colin. That's how you build an empire.
Well, I remember when I would give you a car as an exclusive and you would load it up and put it on the site as a BAT exclusive. And I knew I could tell right away, like I forget what it was when it went live on the site. Like if I didn't get 20 emails in the first hour, I wasn't selling the car.
Yeah. Well, we would make you pick a price, right? We wouldn't let things be POA, and it wasn't obviously an auction. So we would somehow land on a price. And that was the whole magic. We would either miss low and it'd be a flood, or we'd miss high and it'd be crickets. And we'd be like, oh no, we were guessing. Every day we were guessing prices, which was fascinating.
It was fun. I mean, and you talk about how many cars I've sold since you went to the auction platform. I bought and sold a lot of cars through your site before it was an auction platform, including one from your dad.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
L&N. What did he buy from L&N?
Well, my dad found this guy in his neighborhood, as he still does. And yeah, he called it the pastor's bug eye. It was some like church pastor that like the back building at his house or the church or something had a bug eye sprite in it. And, you know, my dad lives near San Jose, California, where like black plate cars in garages was a normal deal forever and ever. And he just pulled a Mercedes out like that. You know, a couple of years ago that he drives now. So anyway, that's always been his thing. And somehow we listed on the site or I forget how it went, but interestingly, yet another model in your repertoire, Colin, like you've raced, I think your wife has raced. You've had a bunch of bug eyes in your past as well, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, that's a Peter Egan problem. That was, I mean, so Egan did a thing at Road America. We have a vintage race in September and he was the guest speaker. You know, I sponsored this vintage race and we always get a guest speaker. We're like, oh, let's get Peter Egan. You know, people love listening to Peter talk. And so he comes there and he gives this great speech about how he raced Road America and basically spent an hour talking about how Bug Eye Sprites are the best race car ever. Because he talked about how horrible they were, but then he kind of made it sound like you couldn't live without one. And, you know, my wife looks at me and she goes, I want a Bug Eye Sprite race car. I was like, damn it, this plan backfired. I thought I'd ever hear about the three main variants and want to be out of it. So I went and bought her a Bug Eye Sprite race car, you know, as a surprise and gave it to her and gave her a bonder on school and all that stuff to get her up to speed. And then she started racing it. And I thought, well, it looks like she's having a lot of fun. So I went and bought a Bug Eye Sprite race car for myself so we could go race together, which for anybody listening, it's not a good idea. If your wife's racing a car, don't race a similar car in the same group, you know, because either she's going to accuse you of taking a dive or she's going to be mad that you're faster. So you just can't win. And I literally mean don't win. Like if you're out there with your wife on the track. But anyway, so then we did that. That's why I bought the car through your dad, the pastor's bug eye, because I remember having to twist his arm because he said he was just inundated with people wanting to buy it. And I said, listen, I really want to buy this for my wife because it had a stuck engine, as you remember. And I said, I want to buy this for my wife because she's racing a Bug Eye Sprite. And I want her to see like what it takes to take one of these engines apart and rebuild it. So I promise that's what I'm doing. I'm not flipping it. So that's why we did the success story, the BAT success story, showing Kana, my wife, how to take the cylinder head off and lap the valves and free a stuck piston and balance carburetors and all that stuff. And, you know, kind of learn how these things work. So yeah, we somehow got involved with these Bug Eye Sprites out. It's insanity. They're total opposite of a Cobra, but they're fun.
And that was a good one. And yeah, you talk about how it used to work. I mean, when I was forwarding all those emails, the seller had a lot of power back then, right? Because I would forward, in that case, my dad, but every seller, like, okay, you got 25 emails inbound, and they're all sort of pleading their case of why they should get the car, right? And so it didn't become a bidding war necessarily, but it became like, who's the most...
You're like the American Idol judge.
Who's the most compelling? And Colin's sitting, you can hear it. Like, he's like pleading his case, like, please sell this car to me.
You get your Culver's gift cards.
So, yeah, I mean, you got to sweeten the deal a little bit, you know, whatever it is. And people would figure that out.
Spotted Cow. And
next time it's got to be the place that Culver's copied. That's the way you get the next one, Colin.
Right.
Are you still messing around with Bug Eyes?
Yeah, we still have our two race Bug Eyes, which are pretty well prepared, and they're good, fun little cars. And we like going out there and beating up on the 356s. So we have those two race cars, and I have one street car, that nice original paint, little California early 58 with a painted windshield post and all that stuff. That's probably going to go away because we just don't use it, but that's where we're at right now. Three Bug Eyes, I think that's plenty.
The family of Bug Eyes.
Yeah.
Amazing. Right.
Our kids are kind of eyeing them up and going, if I reach the pedals, can I? Nope. No, you can't race this car. You're going to race something safe. You know, our son's racing go-karts now, and he's looking at the Trans Am car and going, Dad, I can, nope.
That's an easy jump. Yeah, that's a pretty quick jump after karts, right?
You can't go from 7 horsepower to 850 horsepower.
That's normal.
It's not logical.
Colin, do you remember how you first heard about Bring a Trailer? You were so early on. I think I stumbled into it somehow, 2010, 2011. I can't remember how. Do you remember how you first heard about it?
I think I went to a Texas Roadhouse and it was on the bathroom wall.
Next topic.
No, I really don't. You know, geez, I think it, obviously a friend of mine told me about it because I wouldn't find anything good on my own. And there was a while there where I was just so enthralled with what you were doing, Randy. I was like, this thing is just awesome. And, you know, you're friends with Stuart Schoen and I'm friends with Stuart Schoen. And I went to Stuart and I'm like, hey, you should talk to him. Like, U-Haul, Bring a Trailer. Like,
I've always thought that was a marriage made in heaven. You know, I've had dreams and I've told him this and others. He's affiliated with U-Haul, obviously. And I was like, man, if you can buy a car on BAT and you get like 500 miles of free U-Haul trailer, like that would have been very appealing to me and still is. And sometimes, you know, and figuring out how to patch together some way to drag some car home from who knows where.
I mean, what you did was very much like Sports Car Market. It started as this, Keith was faxing over these pages of Alphas it sold. And all of a sudden you have Sports Car Market magazine and it became more than just Alfa Romeos. So you went from this thing, like this kind of insider only deal. And now I'm not asking you to say how many users you have, but holy cow. I mean,
oh, Randy's happy to tell you.
Yeah. We talk about that all the time. It's crazy. And there are users all over the place, but yeah, there's over 1 million registered accounts on BAT now, right? It's 1.2 million or something. We're getting close to registered accounts. So that's totally crazy. People that care about this crazy stuff. And obviously the model has evolved and the inventory has evolved. It's not all Bug Eyes and, you know, cars we're dragging out of the back of buildings or whatever, but it's pretty cool to see it take fire like that.
Yeah. I mean, like when I put a C4 Corvette on there and it ends up going to Greece or, yeah. And people are asking, like, why would you?
Is that the good news or the bad news? That sounds, I don't know.
No, that car did really well. The one that Randy and I were oogling over was the black saline Fox body.
Oh gosh.
Randy's,
are we really going to
Randy's upset open that can of car's worms not here
at an hour into the podcast? We're going to open
I've been saving
the Steve Saline references. How do you say his last name, Colin?
Saline.
That's like, what I say too. Yeah, what do you, oh man, so many people say saline and it drives me bananas.
Isn't that what's
you go sailing bag? In a boat. Saline in a boat.
Yeah, right. Saline solution for your eyes. Right. But I've always, not that I know better, but that's why I ask you, because I'm sure I bet you've met him and he's shared stories about crashing private planes or whatever, whatever else too. You haven't written a Saline Mustang book, have you?
No, I probably won't because I just...
Speaking of books nobody will buy.
There's actually a lot of books out there on it already. There's like the whole deal. So, but there are people far more well-versed. I just like them because I like Fox Body Mustangs and I think that's like the Shelby version. So.
Yeah.
But when they were 15 grand and I was buying them up and I had told you, you said, I kind of like those. I was sending, by mistake, I sold the two white with blue stripe cars. I sent them to meet them and you made the comment, like, oh, why would you rent them there? I'm like, well, you can still go there and buy them.
And I should have. I remember those, yeah, sitting on the showroom floor at Frontier Ford right here in the Bay Area. My dad is buying an Aerostar for our family, and there's a Celine Mustang brand new on the showroom floor. I mean, those sort of memories never, ever, ever go away. Like, Dad, why can't you buy the terrible decision sitting on the showroom floor instead of a family car? And those were there, man. 87, 88, brand spanking new.
You've got a lot of great cars, Randy, but there's a Fox body shaped hole in that.
In my heart.
I know.
In my heart. Yep. Yep. Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody wants a car that rides horribly and isn't really fast.
Oh man, Colin, we could talk for, we didn't dive into racing. We didn't talk airplanes, which is, I'll have to wait till Randy's not here to stare daggers at me to talk airplanes. I want to do that with you. I'd love to do this again sometime so we could dive into buying and selling on Bring a Trailer. I mean, you know, our success is thanks in no small part to folks like yourself who are seasoned, fantastic sellers who know how to present the hell out of a car. And so we could probably spend a whole episode just talking about how you do that because you do such a great job. We want to wrap up here pretty soon. But before we do, I asked this to Peter Egan last week, and I would like to ask it to you too, Colin, because you're just such a wealth of knowledge on, again, on everything kind of car related. What was the last great thing you drove or the last great thing that really got you juiced up or excited?
Boy, that's a tough one. I mean, I guess recently I bought a 240Z, a 71 240Z. Mm-hmm. My friend's dad bought it new. You know, it's like a 40,000 mile car. It's just been sitting in a garage forever. And they called me and wanted me to sell it for them. And I, you know, we picked the car up, got out of the garage, got it back to Wisconsin. And I said, let's just get it here. And I'll take a look at it and tell you what I think it's worth and what we should do with it. And I got it back here. I said, I got to be honest with you. I got to own this car. So here's what I think it's worth. I'll pay them whatever you think. And, you know, they thought about it. And I think they were kind of confused as to why I would pay more than I told them it was worth. But I just wanted the car. So that kind of thing, still, it doesn't matter the price of the car. Like finding a good car and something that's cool. And I love early Z cars. And so now I'm like messing around with it. And we're dry ice blasting it, and, you know, getting it running again. And I like projects like that. I like finding stuff that, you know, good story, one owner cars, great history, you know, original paint. Like these are all like my hot buttons, finding stuff that has just been hiding away. I drive all kinds of cars, but to find something neat that hasn't been, especially in this day and age where everything seems to trade hands, like everything's had 100 owners and everything's been to 5 different auctions in the past 10 years. I want the car that hasn't been to auction. That's all. That's what really kind of trips my trigger is finding, it's having something pop up where you're like, oh man, I can't wait to get that car home and see what it's all about.
Well, that's why we're always so excited to see whatever you bring to Bring a Trailer next, Colin. Well, thanks so much for doing this. Any parting shots, Randy?
No, I'm just super psyched that we got to chat.
You definitely left a lot on the table. We'll have to do this again.
Well, we could, as you could tell, we could share stories and talk to Colin for a super long time. Thanks for your time, Colin. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. As always, please let us know if you have any feedback or suggestions, podcast@bringatrailer.com. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.